I had all the toys, big houses, big cars, big ego. But, you know, I discovered they meant very little.
We did not think that Edna had any money. We didn't think she was penniless, but her only source of income, as far as we were aware, was her state pension. And as it turned out, that was true. It was her only source of income. But I found in her paperwork when we were clearing the house out, details where she had inherited in two wills. And I imagine that is where her money came from. And whether she then didn't feel able to spend that, I don't know.
I'm Alvin Hall, and this is Misers, Bling, and the Money Thing for the BBC World Service. That person you always assume lives close to the financial edge could be sitting on a fortune but doesn't feel like using it. For some people, the temptation to spend on goods that make their lives shinier, swisher, and smoother is all-consuming. For others, there's really no temptation. In this program, I'll be delving into the lives of people who have decided that spending their money on consumables isn't the be-all and end-all. Barney Curley is a racing man who has the bookies running for cover. Over the decades, he has made millions from betting on horse racing. Big wins include £3.9 million in 2010 and £2 million at the start of this year. But he's not your typical successful gambler who indulges in his winning. He spoke to me from his home in the horse racing town of Newmarket in England. Barney, you have made a lot of money over your lifetime. What do you think your motivation was?
Well, I never had a great regard for money. I think it was just the buzz of beating the system.
And do you still get that buzz?
It's waning. You know, it's waning.
Why do you think it's waning?
I suppose I'm getting older. Money isn't very important. And I'm more interested in the work in Africa. That's where I get the buzz now at the moment.
Tell me about your work in Africa.
Well, we have a charity in Zambia. You know, we have schools there with 1,600 kids at the schools, a couple of schools. And we now have a big project called Virtual Learning. So what we're doing is we are sending in the curriculum from a college in Ireland straight into Zambia. They have the same teachers as beamed in on the internet, and when they qualify, they get the same marks and the same standing as would say a college in the UK.
Let's go back to 1975 when you first won a big amount of money. Barney, how did you feel and what did you want to do with that money?
I bought a mansion and lived there for a number of years, but I never was content there. No, although it was a beautiful place, you know, I always thought in Ireland at that time there wasn't much money around. And here was I living in this mansion with all the mod cons. You know, I just felt a little bit awkward.
And what else did you buy yourself?
Of course, I bought myself a few racehorses. But looking back on that episode of my life, it was a mistake.
Really?
It was a mistake, yeah. I could have put the money to better use.
What would have been better use with that money for you, Barney?
You know, if I'd have known what I know now, a better use would have been in Africa.
Has come alongside Cork All-Star as they take the second last.
So when you placed that very complicated bet in which you won, I think it was £3.9 million, what did that feel like for you?
Well, I was sitting in the same chair I'm sitting in now, and it was okay. As they say over here, it was nothing to write home about. You know, I would get a much bigger buzz, we'll say, in Zambia to see these children running around in the playground with their school uniforms on, very clean, learning something.
I was reading the biography that you did, and it described you in one part as completely cold and unemotional about gambling. Do you think that's part of your success, that you're able to remove the emotion from it and strictly see the odds and structure the deal so you have a better chance of winning?
I think that might be so, because, you know, when I'm gambling, that's true. I am, you know what I mean? I do be cold. I have this system. Do the best you can, get everything prepared, and then it's up to the horses. You know, me getting excited or whatever doesn't make any difference.
So when you were able to coordinate all of these people to place these bets and come out with this big win, as it became clearer and clearer to you that you just might win, was there a moment when you raised your hand above your head and went, yeah, yeah, it's going to work?
No, I don't think so. I was just sitting in the chair watching it all happen. And if it came, it came. And if it didn't come, you know what I mean? There was no lives lost.
Barney is a man who has reflected on his life and has decided that his higher calling is helping others. He still has not lost his taste for gambling, but he uses his proceeds in a way that he finds far more satisfying than simply winning. Over a period of 15 years, Phil White's charity work brought her into regular contact with Edna Hales, and they became close. Edna relied on the charity to take her to see a close friend, and she refused the idea of paying for much-needed help in her home. When Edna died, it was up to Phil and her husband to go through Edna's belongings.
Edna, I don't think, had thrown anything out for about 40 years. Literally. The house was absolutely crammed. So we started to clear some of the stuff out, and there was a gift bag on a chair, like a bottle bag, actually one that we had given to her because we used to buy her half a bottle or a bottle of brandy or whiskey every Christmas. And it had still got the tag on that I'd written when we'd given it to her a few Christmases ago. And I picked it up to move it. We were going to throw it away. And as I picked it up, I thought, oh, that feels rather thick. Somebody must have left the cardboard piece from inside in an awkward way. So I opened the bag and put my hand inside and found an envelope. And when I opened the envelope, the will was inside it. And it named the solicitor who was to deal with it. It named not the charities, but the conditions that she wanted to help. So there were things like diabetes, blindness, Alzheimer's. And when I spoke to the solicitor, I was told that as I was named as the executor, that meant that I would have to decide which of these charities were to receive the money.
In total, Edna left £150,000 to charity, a substantial sum for someone who relied on charity. And it was a sum that could have made Edna's life a lot easier. Phil still doesn't know why.
But she was a very, very private person. And didn't discuss money. And we thought that she, as I said, not penniless, but that she had no spare money. She didn't scrimp on things like heating. Her house was always warm. She ate reasonably well, although very, very small amounts. But didn't discuss money at all. In fact, when she was very ill towards the end and in hospital, and social services were trying to find out her financial status so that they could assess if she came out her contribution to a home, she would talk to them about anything they asked until they mentioned money. And as soon as they mentioned money, she either ignored them or she changed the subject completely. And I've known her say to this social worker, "Oh, I like your ring. I wish I had one like that." Or, "Haven't you got nice teeth?" And she would just totally change the money. She would, the subject, she wouldn't discuss money at all. with anybody. But we took it that that was because she was just a very private person. She felt that her finances were her business and nobody else's. And to be honest, when I found out that she did have all this money, I was a little bit annoyed with her that she didn't use some of that to make her life more comfortable while she was still alive.
I have known people like Edna. Often they have set their priorities, they're content in their lives, and they see no reason to change things even when money comes their way. They continue to live life as they always have.
I like to say I'm frugal. Other people might describe me as stingy.
Arthur Ben Hatch is someone who enjoys saving for long foreign vacation. But he saves money in what might be described in often eccentric ways.
When we go anywhere and stay in a hotel, breakfast buffets I raid mercilessly. To begin with, I was quite careful about the way I did this. I would sneak into the buggy basket of the kids a roll, perhaps when the waitress's back was turned, filling a coffee machine. But lately, I've become completely brazen, and I now woof everything in sight, bacon, sausages, eggs, anything, and I put it in the buggy basket, and I even ask sometimes for a napkin to wrap it all up in from the waitress. Quite a lot of the clothes I'm in today are my dad's clothes. I also buy, I have got in trouble in the past, I should say, for buying my wife clothes from a charity shop. The worst example probably was the coat I bought her for her 40th birthday that I stupidly forgot to take the age concern label out of the back. She was quite upset on the day to discover the label and realise that I bought it from a charity shop. As good a coat as it was. This was when we went to Disneyland in Paris. Well, I decided that it was too expensive, really, to pay for food in there. It was about €6 for a slice of pizza. And I decided that we would smuggle in our lunch. We hid food on their bodies. We kind of muled the lunch in. I put some ham in their shoes and we put some cheese in their shoes. And then I strapped half baguette halves to each of their calves and then rolled their trousers down and we went in that way. That they probably thought was getting a little bit too far. The baguettes rubbed the back of their knees a little bit. They're a little bit crusty. And that they weren't very happy about that, let's say.
Stories to laugh about at family gatherings, maybe. But upon reflection, Ben thinks perhaps this behavior didn't start with him.
It's the root to my behavior has come from my mum, almost certainly. Her tooth fell out once, and rather than go to the dentist, she actually superglued the tooth back into her mouth. That's the kind of level of extremity that she existed at.
As it happens, Ben's father was a successful figure in BBC Radio, having the luxury of a chauffeur-driven car and meeting high-profile figures. Despite this, Ben's mother insisted on continuing her job ironing clothes every day for decades. It was this example that Ben thinks influenced his attitude toward money.
Just before my mother died of cancer, she gave me, my brother and sister, she took us out for a meal, which was almost unheard of anyway. And at this meal, she unfurled. She was very poorly at this point. She could hardly walk. And it was kind of the latter stages of the cancer. And she unfurled these three checks for my brother, my sister and I for £20,000 each. And this was money she saved herself from ironing at £5 an hour, which seemed an incredible thing at the time, and it still seems incredible now, really. And it is something that set me, my brother and sister up for the rest of our lives and all through this incredible hard work. And I think the fact that she'd earned that money in such a difficult way made money seem, I don't know, more precious and more hard fought than it would have done otherwise. And I think probably that's the way that I've gone, is because of that.
Seeing someone work really hard, especially at a menial job, can really influence you. My grandmother worked very hard at a low-level job as a maid, but yet she was able to save money. I think that her diligence and her focus on saving had a huge influence on me. Up next, someone who believes in not splashing the cash, or more accurately, in selectively splashing it.
You know what they say? I mean, you've probably read The Millionaire Next Door, right?
I have.
Are you
the millionaire next door to me?
they said that the average millionaire has never spent more than $50 for a pair of shoes and drives an old car. I mean, Warren Buffett, right, was a billionaire until recently, was driving a beat-up pickup truck, right? Now I think he drives a CTS or something. But no, I mean, I think anyone who has developed wealth, I think, knows how to save money. And the nouveau riche, you know, they're throwing money around. And they say sometimes that person you see in that fancy car may actually, you know, be struggling to make payments.
That's
on
true.
Car, right? So I've always been very frugal in that way. But at the same time, I like to think I live a very full life. I mean, it's one thing to be frugal and then restrict the fun you have and the joy of life. And I don't do that ever. I'm all about, you know, living life to its fullest. Experiences are more important than things, traveling, etc. I mean, I think I have a great life.
And people always tell me, your dad is from India and your mom is from Japan, so that makes you half Asian.
My first memory is about money. I think I got a bicycle when I was 4 years old, and my father, of course, I had training wheels on it, and then he took off one training wheel, and I guess when we came home at night, I fell over, and I was crying and screaming at him, and I think he told me that it cost $25, and I didn't really care because I was 4 years old. I was more worried that I'd fallen and hurt myself.
So he had spent $25 on you, and he told you he had spent that money.
Right.
Was that typical of your family?
Oh, well, you know, my dad's from India, my mom is from Japan, and so it's unbelievable. When you're, you know, it's an Asian family, it's all about saving money and turning down the heat and turning down the air conditioning and recycling the paper. And I mean, I've had a ream of paper for, I think, 3 years, 500 sheets. Even now, as an adult, I barely use paper, and if I do, I use the back.
In this tight money situation, how did that shape your career once you went to university? What did you do?
Well, when I went to university, I had the chance of going to a Ivy League school or going to the state school that was near my parents.
And that's a real big difference in terms of cost, isn't it?
It's an order of magnitude. It's at least 10 times. And my father made me pay for my education all by myself. Everyone had their parents paying college, but he said, you've got to pay for everything yourself. And I did. And so I went to state school, and it was, again, one-tenth as expensive.
Wow. Did you feel deprived then?
No, I've never felt deprived. And the other thing is I worked when I was in college as well. I was cleaning food off of plates in the dining hall and scrubbing toilets. And then I got onto the co-op program where I worked for IBM. And I took 3 semesters off from school to work. And so that helped me put myself through school. So I think it's great, you know, for young people to learn the value of money. And if you have your college paid for and your parents buy you your first car, I think you don't value it as much.
Really?
Yes.
Do you enjoy accumulating money? Because you invest, as I invest, I find it sometimes exciting. But often the motivation for me is not necessarily the amount of money that I make, the fact that I recognize a trend.
I think so. I think when you're able to call a stock and see it go up, especially with options, because as you know, it can increase, you know, many fold. I mean, that's an aphrodisiac. It's fantastic to see your money growing, you know.
Dan, what does money mean to you?
Money means to me, I think it's freedom, because if you have it in the bank, it just sits there. But if you spend it and you use it, then it means it can buy you not necessarily happiness. I mean, the great David Lee Roth said, you know, people say money can't buy you happiness, but it can sure buy a nice yacht to pull up right alongside it.
There, the cream really rising to the top here. Captain CB's just in behind them, and there they fly over.
Barney, I've interviewed a lot of people over the years, and I've never interviewed anybody like you who has decided that life is better to be simple, and who has decided that being a philanthropist and helping others is so important to him. And I know part of this comes out of the death of your son, but you're unusual. You're unusual.
Someone said one time, it's in the giving we receive. And I have to say, my small giving, I have received a lot.
Do you feel that part of it is because you gave yourself everything you could possibly want with money, and now you don't need any of it?
Well, I felt that all the toys, you know, weren't for me. They gave me very little. And I think it's a mistake to build up all this wealth.
When you see people who earn a lot of money today, whether it's footballers or entrepreneurs, people in technology, and you see them driving their Maseratis or their Ferraris and flying privately, what do you say to yourself?
Well, if I was betting, I would bet that they're not happy. This volunteer out in Zambia asked him one day, what is the most important thing in life? He said, peace of mind. I doubt if a lot of those people have peace of mind.
Among people who are frugal, peace of mind comes in many variations, some positive, some negative. Some find peace of mind in denying themselves, some in holding on to money, some find pride in just not spending money in useless ways at all, and others find peace of mind in helping others. In all cases, frugality seems to be deeply personal, rooted in some past experience. It is as self-defining for them as it is for the person who spends money recklessly. I'm Alvin Hall, and next week I'll look at people who love to show what their money can buy in Misers, Bling, and the Money Thing.